You walk in here because
what happened?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It's in two parts,
Omarosa,
and I emailed it. But I think you can get it so that she can connect here and get online and watch
yep,
it.
Exactly.
You can watch it. Okay. Why does it need department approval?
Okay, so we have some special guests today from the mayor's office. As the council members know, there is a swearing in ceremony on Monday 17th with the mayor. However, because not everyone can make that event, we also invited Mr. Roy. And his assistant to come today to swear in the members that are here. And then if you're going to that ceremony, that's sort of the photo op with the mayor. So you're invited to go to that ceremony as well, but we wanted to make sure we caught as many people as possible. And we also have certificates for you to sign for your next term. So the existing terms, there's some people who haven't been sworn in at all because they're newer. Then there's other people who have been here on the committee since 2015, but those terms end on September 30th, 2018. So we're basically swearing you in now for a next three-year term. One of the items that we'll probably discuss in the next meeting is the vision statement for this council and how we might want to change it as we move towards the remedial design, but we're not going to discuss that now. But I did leave here copies of the vision statement that we have in place now and the list of the members. So,
All right. So, everyone who's being sworn in, I'll have you guys stand and raise your right hand.
Jeez, I'm going to do it on Monday. Should I do it twice?
Yeah, you should do it.
That's fine. Okay. You can do it twice. The second time is just with the mayor. And you can take a photo with the mayor as well. This just makes it easier to get your oath signed and have it in our database as well. That's it. Okay. Repeat after me. I. Frank, I'm sorry. Your name?
Jim Foster.
Having been appointed as?
Having been appointed as
member of the Leadership Council for a Cleaner Anacostia River. Do solemnly swear or affirm that.
I.
Your name again?
Jim Foster.
Will support and defend.
The
Constitution of the United States. That I will perform such duties as may be assigned to me. As member of the Leadership Council for a Cleaner Anacostia River. To the best of my ability. Without fear or favor. That I will exercise my best judgment. And will consider each matter before me. From the viewpoint of the best interest of. The District of Columbia. As a whole. And that I will faithfully discharge said duties.
Right,
and I'll just have you guys continue to raise your right hand, and I'll take a quick photo op as well. You guys that are here, are you?
Yes.
I'm here. All right, you can jump in the photo as well.
Can I?
Yeah.
It's one of the unindicted for conspiracy. Take two.
Yeah, that light is good. Can we have it like you guys come over here? Because of the light from the projector. The light from the projector is just flashing. Yes. You guys can act like you like each other. Oh, there it is. All right, perfect. Thank you, guys. Oh, and one with your hands raised, your right hand.
Oh, good, right?
Yeah. Big smile, big smile. On three. One, two, three. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you. Watch your step. I think because we're tight on time, I'll let you do the signing part of the sheets, and we'll continue on. Okay, so first on the agenda is the pilot muscle studies, and I think the pilot muscle studies have been getting a lot of good press, so we decided to have both USGS and WAS tell their part of the story. So USGS is
Fish and Wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife.
It's okay.
Fish and Wildlife, the federal people. Okay, so Fish and Wildlife. We'll be telling the both sides of the story, and Fred and Louise will go first, and Mr. Siegelin will introduce our speakers specifically. He has the bios.
Okay.
You can sign
it. Okay, hi everybody. I'm Doug Siegelin, and I swear I am not, and I have never been a member of the Leadership Council or the Internet Copyright, but I am representing the Williams and Camping. So I don't really need to introduce these guys. Everybody has worked with Fred for a very long time, and I guess we'll say Luis is an undergrad student studying environmental science and technology at College Park, and he was selected for the directorate fellowship program to conduct the study with Dr. Pittman.
So I'm just going to talk for about 30 seconds and hand it over to Luis. So just for context, this is the second study that we're doing with freshwater mussels in the Anacostia tributaries and main stem. The first study was in association with Upal Ghosh and the USGS people to look at bioaccumulation of mussels, and we used adult Elliptio complanata cages for 3 months and 5 months in 2 years, and we had excellent survival. And that led to this study, thinking that maybe the Anacostia is ripe for freshwater mussel restoration. And so Luis did his summer project directed at that question, will juvenile mussels survive and grow, and which locations will they do better in?
So the study I conducted was for survival and growth of juvenile mussels within the Anacostia River and watershed. Worked alongside Prince Higsby, Lance Yonkos, professor from University of Maryland, and Jack Stanson, who was an intern who was a student at the University of Maine.
Please speak up, please.
So the purpose of this project was to establish a baseline for juvenile freshwater survival and growth in the Anacostia River and tributaries. We chose to use the eastern lamp mussel, Lampsilus radiata, because it is a native mussel and it is also hardy and can tolerate a variety of different substrates. These are the sites that we use. As you can see, our southernmost site is actually in the Potomac River. It is our reference site because we collected the mussel, the female mussel that produced all the offspring we would use in the study. The rest of our sites are within the Anacostia River, the tidal portion, and in the non-tidal we have up in Beaver Dam Creek, we have two sites. Each of these sites were either set with one of two types of housings. One would be the baskets, which I'll talk about later, and the other would be the silos. And there was 80 mussels in total at each site. So these are the two different housings we used. On the right, well, on your left, you can see the silos. They would sit at the base of the river or stream bed, and the mussels would be contained within throughout the duration of the study. It was a 10-week study. And then these are the floating baskets on your right that we used, and they just maintain at the surface of the water column throughout the study. So we picked up a total of 1,700 mussels from Harrison Lake National Fish Hatchery in Charles City, Virginia. And upon receiving these mussels, what we did was we selected the bigger mussels to use for this study because we thought they would be hardier and have better survival. And we only needed 800, so we had 900 to spare. And then here at the bottom, you can see a photograph where we set these muscles on a 10 by 10 millimeter grid. And the purpose of this was to get initial measurements of the muscles for every site we deployed at, so we can see the average length of the muscles that went into each silo and each basket. So after the housings were deployed, we monitored them weekly. We recorded water quality data, we recorded dissolved oxygen, pH, conductivity, and
temperature.
And then we also had to monitor them weekly because of storm events or high energy movements within the water column. Sometimes we would get situations like here in the middle where the silo would pull up all the sediment and become filled to the brim, and this could suffocate the mussels. If we didn't get to them in time, they could all perish. So it was important to get out there and make sure we could clear it out to give our mussels the best chance of survival possible. And then here on the right is just like debris that we could find sometimes floating in the river. It's just a giant hunk of metal I had to remove off the silos. So we collected measurements for the mussels on 5 week period, which is a halfway point. And at the 10 week period, here we have a photograph of the 5 week analysis of the lengths of the mussels. I used a program called ImageJ, which allowed me to drag lines across the lengths and heights of these mussels. And you can see it gives me the millimeters, size in millimeters of these mussels. So I only have the 5 week data to present today because we did not finish analyzing the 10 week data yet. But for 5 weeks, we had excellent survival across the growth, excellent survival across the board. Except for confluence, which was a little less at 73% survival, but all other sites had above 90% survival.
Is that the confluence of the Anacostia and the Potomac?
It's actually the confluence of the Northeast and Northwest Branch.
Okay. All right, what's going on here?
Okay, so.
When we see some of those cages are all filled with sediment, did you count those out?
Yeah, so I actually have to sit through them, pick out every muscle individually, set them aside, and then take out the remaining sediment out of that silo. Because there's no sediment supposed to be in there at all. So it would be a lengthy
process. The survival doesn't reflect the sediment that suffocated those.
So we actually managed to get to them before they suffocated.
I think we want length.
We went after rain events. The picture I showed you was actually at a beaver dam site, which we had 100% survival at. So this graph here is for a reference of length within these sites. The yellow on the left is the pre-deployment average when we set them into the water. The blue are the sites with baskets in them. You can see they're a little bigger. And then the red are the silo containers. And as you can see, we have two sites that didn't actually grow very much. And these are within the non-tidal portion of the tributary. So from the data we collected, we could see that it would be supported to repopulate the tidal portion of the river with mussels. I feel like it would be beneficial and it would help improve our water quality. They remove suspended sediments and they can contain algal blooms. They could make use of the excess nutrients within the system. As far as the non-tidal portion of the river, we really did only study Beaver Dam Creek. And here, I don't think it would be adequate to reintroduce juvenile mussels because even though we had really good survivals at these sites, it really didn't grow. So that would probably indicate that it couldn't support a thriving population which could reproduce. And so it really wouldn't be beneficial to focus efforts here. I believe that is all I have. Questions? Yes.
Yeah, it just looks like it doesn't have. The result doesn't have a whole couple of to do with the contaminants. It has more to do with the water flow and But when you're looking at the free flowing streams versus the tidal, it seems like the sedimentation and whether they can. Does it make sense? It doesn't seem to reflect the contaminants that have the impact on the.
Do you want to take this or you want me to? We suspect that the differences in growth are probably due more likely than not to food availability, and we're having water samples that were collected at 3, 6, and 9 weeks analyzed for ceston, which is the particle size that they eat, both the quantity and the quality in terms of carbohydrate. It's also, Beaver Dam had lower temperature, so they would grow a little bit less than the other sites. As far as contaminants, it really wasn't the objective of the study, but I suspect that you're right.
Well, one other thing that the past conversation we have had on this issue indicated that a lot of these, the lump mussel and the other native species are present, but not abandoned in those areas. How come they are not thriving if they're already there? I'm just wondering, again, does it have to do with the hydrology? Does it have to do with sedimentation rate?
Well, it takes them, I mean, they're very long-lived animals, so it might be that things have improved, but, and maybe we're on a very slow trajectory to repopulate now, but by adding thousands of hatchery-generated mussels, we could speed up that process considerably.
Jeff?
Along the same lines, I just with all the intensive maintenance of having to clean water every week, a population survival zone with this intense sedimentation that's going on.
So that sedimentation actually only happened in the non-tidal portion of the river, which was the Beaver Dam Creeks, which I actually don't think we should focus efforts in these areas. But in the other tidal portions of the river, we did not have that issue, and they were actually pretty low maintenance in those areas. We just went out there to make sure they were still in the ground and upright. Really didn't do much to them. Yes.
So are there other studies where repopulation efforts have been tried, and what were the results?
So this is the first study of its kind here in the Anacostia River, but in the Delaware estuary, they have performed studies and they have been using mussels to remediate their waters. And I think it'd be beneficial to kind of mimic what they've done and also work using mussels as a remediation effort here in these waters.
All right, I think we'll move on to the second part of this talk, which is by the Anacostia Watershed Society. And we all know Mr. Foster, so we will take it away.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
How the heck are you? So happy Thursday. We are working with Fred, but also with Maryland DNR, Matt Ashton, and looking at a couple different ideas for mussel restoration in the river. So again, you know, we're really talking about a space that's small enough that we can, I think, have a big impact on making mussels flourish a little bit more and help us as part of the restoration. So. All right, so I want to make sure, you know, just showing you all where the watershed is, and, you know, what's our mission is, you know, stopping and preventing pollution, reconnecting the community, and restoring natural systems. So I consider working with mussels similar to what we're doing with shad restoration or wild rice, wetland restoration work, things like that. You want me to click this thing?
No.
So why restore mussels in the Anacostia River? Well, frankly, they are our freshwater oysters. We are looking hard at, on a big picture, looking at oyster restoration in the Chesapeake Bay to help us. Obviously, we want to stop the sediment and contaminants and pollutants at the source. I mean, let's be clear, that's the real objective. This isn't the be-all, end-all, but what this does is, just like with submerged aquatic vegetation, where we had a huge jump in the last year on submerged aquatic vegetation, we think that mussels are part of that circle that will help filter the water, allow more submerged aquatic vegetation, allow it to be more robust, and kind of create a perpetual motion machine where, you know, as the water gets cleaner, more submerged aquatic vegetation, and then more mussels. Next. So it helps improve not only water quality, but habitat. Mussels are key to the food chain that we're looking at in the animals in the river. And so it just helps us create a more robust habitat there. What I like to tell people is we have so little habitat in open space and natural areas that all those areas need to be as robust and efficient and effective as possible. Okay, efficient and effective, that's on the quiz. Next. So the clean river, of course, benefits all of us. So what's been done so far? We've worked with DNR to do a survey. Matt Ashton, the Assessment of Freshwater Mussel Community of the Tidal Freshwater Anacostia River. Matt published that. And we were really surprised to find lots of mussels in places, particularly at Buzzard Point, and not so much in, you know, some other places, but it's coming. And again, we think it's really, if we don't spend a little bit of time studying it, we won't be able to do what's right as we to help really make it a robust propagation. Next. So then we worked with Fred on his piece of the study, and then we're going to carry forward on through the rest of the year. Next, where we are, we've got mussels from the Harrison Lake hatchery. That mussel there and another one basically turned out 35,000 babies. And we ended up with about 10,000, and we've deployed 5,800 into the river at seven different locations where there's four different baskets. So we'll be studying them over the next year for survivability and growth and such, just as Fred was doing for 10 weeks, was it?
Mm-hmm.
So what have we discovered so far? These are the different oysters that we see in the, or oysters, the different mussels that we see in the river. And just to, you know, these are critically impaired. These are critically impaired. These are vulnerable. I don't expect you to be able to see all that, but it's just important to know that the state and the district have their eyes on this as far as you know, whether they're endangered or impaired and all. Next. So let's skip over this. So they are reproducing. That's what's really cool. We're seeing the eastern floater in particular and the eastern pond mussel really starting to reproduce in the river. That's very exciting.
Next.
And we think it's basically because we are seeing better clarity in the water. We're seeing better oxygen and a little bit less sedimentation. But we really think that it's going to happen in baskets up higher in the water where it's a little safer. It's also a little warmer, and they'll be able to use that to really take off and reproduce. I want to point out that Beaver Dam Creek is not Lower Beaver Dam, it's Upper Beaver Dam Creek, basically. It's Beaver Dam Creek up in USDA. All right, what are we planning to do next? Continue propagation, you know, and engage the community and educate them about this. We think that mussels can really add to the long-term cleanup and restoration of the river and water quality and help flatten out our robust habitat improvements by, you know, as we work to bring back a full complement of animals in the river. But we want to determine the suitability and long-term viability of these release sites. So as Fred had started to do a little bit, and where these guys are saying, it doesn't look really good up here, we want to do the same sort of thing over the next year at these seven different locations along the river, the tidal portion of the river. So again, we've got floating baskets at seven sites, 300 juveniles per basket. There's four baskets at each site, and then the two different kinds of mussels. So we'll look at mortality and average growth over the next 12 months, and then release them in the river at a site to be determined. And then you know, we'll be tagging some of them to see how they do past that. We have some funding from a couple different sources, including National Park Service, the Chesapeake office, And we're excited about that. Thank you to Bob Campbell out there. And we really want to do a Muscles in the Classroom thing, similar to what we've been doing with Shad over the years and our Rice Rangers program. We think that it's a fabulous way to engage students, and particularly with STEM, they'll be helping us do some monitoring of the muscles over time. So, last but least, I got to sell this. Hey, get involved. Step up. Join us. Help us with the maintenance and monitoring and, you know, the student experience. Okay? I think that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Happy kids in mud.
Happy kids in mud. Yeah, you can't get them into the mud, and then you can't get them out. Muscling our way to a cleaner Anacostia. I think I saw your hand up first.
Doug had his hand before.
Sir.
So, Jim or Luis or Fred, if we had a full complement of mussels in, back in the river, what would be different about the water quality? What do they really do?
Well, again, they're filter feeders. They filter about 10 gallons a day each. They're going to take...
And what do they filter?
The sediment that's in the river and other nutrients out of the river.
So they take out the sediment?
And bacteria.
That's what I'm trying to get to. Take, so what's the full effect here?
I guess one, if they potentially, and we don't know this how this would work on a big scale, is if you have something taking E. coli out of the water column, now you have something that's helping the progress towards making the river swimmable. And I don't know what the scale of that is, but it has been shown that they will reduce the water column concentration of E. coli. But that's only been done on a very small scale.
And I don't think we're under any illusions that this is the you know, way to clean water without stopping stuff at the source. I just want to be really clear about that. But
yeah, I'm not challenging. I'm just asking. I understand they take out the nutrients.
And a sediment.
They probably take out the sediment as,
right.
as a function of that.
Basic sediment, nutrient, bacteria, uptake of contaminants. There you got to be careful, because now you're thinking, okay, well, am I taking stuff that's in small quantities in the water column, packing them up, and bigger fish are going to start eating it. So you got to go step by step and figure out, you know, it's like a doctor. You want to do no harm first. So I just caution you that that's a consideration too.
Yeah, one thing that's really... having looked at Anacostia's water to do for the last 10 years, you know that there's a lot of nutrient in water. There's a lot of nutrient in the sediments. One reason you don't have really major eutrophication and algal bloom is because life doesn't go down. And now, one concern I have, this is wonderful that they filter out of the water column, but then it's going to be clear. Radiation goes all the way down, and everything can start cooking, which right now it is, but it's not as severe as when water is clear. So what I suggest probably what we could couple with this, either with citizen monitoring or classroom stuff, to at the same time on the sites where you are having these mussels, to look at the temperature, water clarity, et cetera, to see if we do this, do we trigger in things that we haven't anticipated would trigger?
Sure.
Because then potentially you can have massive algal bloom, which then they die, and then they have hypoxia, things like that. So it would be a good complement. And we have extensive monitoring that you probably know some of our staff. We can couple those stuff with
Absolutely. So two answers to your statement there. So basically, this isn't going to turn into a billion mussels tomorrow. We're trying to study what works best, so we don't have a big failure. But also, how is it marrying up with the bigger sediment remediation study? So it's certainly not this is what we're doing instead of everything else, but it's a complement to it, and I think it needs to be looked at from that perspective. So just as the Chesapeake Bay is trying to do 10 billion oysters, I think we need to look at where we can have a great propagation of freshwater mussels. Thank you. Bill.
Well, you sort of covered it, but I'm interested in your sense of ranking the relative benefits.
Writing?
Ranking.
The relative benefits. So, great question. What are the benefits? It's certainly a piece of the puzzle, just like wild rice is. We are looking to have a balanced ecosystem. We just are finishing up repurposing a lot of geese from the river, resident geese, and it's critical to understand that we've got a lot of animals coming back to the river that we didn't have for many years here. And how does all this come into play together? I think that, you know, 3 years from now, we're going to be talking about the deer, you know, and what a big problem they are, you know. And just as we're talking about, you know, dog waste and how it's impacting the river. So I think that there's an introduction to the benefits to the habitat, but also it's very clear to people. They make a very clear line, draw a very clear line from, oh, I get it, if mussels can survive and they're in there helping, we're going to end up with a cleaner river. So it is part and parcel with engagement and helping ultimately clean up the river. So I don't think that we'll ever have these mussels looked at as a food source, but I do think that someday when we are allowed to have commercial fishing again in the river, that it will be, somebody will look at having baskets of mussels or snails or whatever that they are growing in the river. And so that's a ways off. We're still in the early stages of you know, putting that piece back into the puzzle. Great question.
Okay, thank you. One more.
Real quick. Sure that the mussel species that were selected are native for the area of business. Just out of curiosity, like zebra mussel, impacted that in Lake Erie in the late 70s.
Right now?
Yeah, they still are, but they tremendous impact on water clarity. And we had a huge issue, I think it was chlorophyll from some of the impact on zebra mussel. I mean, they proliferated throughout the southern portion of Lake Erie, especially. The type of selections were made based on the yield, or anticipated yield or performance of a particular mussel species.
Well, we had 8 to pick from. The hatchery had a facility for working with the eastern lamp mussel that we chose to work with, and the 2 species that Jim's working with. Lamp mussel we really chose because of its hardiness, and it has a wide variety of host fish species. So I guess you're asking in terms of risk, is that where you're getting at?
Kind of, yes.
Since this was a captive study where we weren't going to release anything, and it is a native species, we really didn't factor into our thought process.
It will be what it will be.
Right.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear that we harvested these mussels from the river, took them to the hatchery. So it wasn't like we imported them from someplace else. Thank you. Anybody else?
I don't know if this is for Jim or Fred or what, but as the growth rate was lower up in the tributary, but you're really only looking at one type of mussel, are there different types of mussels that are kind of found in the tidal versus the tributary areas? And is it going to be that some mussels will do better in one area and not the other? And is that part of what you're looking at?
You want me to take that?
Well, you start, yeah.
Okay. So the survey that Matt Ashton did was largely focused on the tidal river, and his assessment as a mussel expert is that a lot of the non-tidal area, the gradient is too steep, and that mussels may not be there because it's just they're going to get blown out. And so part of our thoughts would be the baskets might be sort of the nursery stage for mussels, where you grow them up until they're, you know, robust size like this, and then they might be able to tolerate some of the slower moving water in the tributaries because they're big enough to get themselves attached. So Luis's data that shows no growth, we don't want to overinterpret that to mean that don't go in the non-tidal areas.
Yeah, and I think that it's really, you know, a function of different environment there with much cooler water,
yeah.
And so you're just going to see much less growth in that. But what we will do is look at you know, survivability and suitability over the next year, and it'd give us a little bit better time frame, you know, bad winter, things like that. So I'm sure we'll come away with six more questions to ask after. Thank you all.
So Tim Wilson's back with us today, and it's probably worth actually reading his statement so that you have some context. He's been with USGS for 25 years as a geochemist, specializing in contaminant transport in rivers. He's based in New Jersey, but has been exiled to the Maryland office for the past several years, working on the Anacostia River drift studies. Previous projects included contaminant transport in the New Jersey and New York Harbor areas.
I took this up in New York and New Jersey, and my co-worker, Chuck Walker, thank you. So let's get going. I'm afraid I have numbers, and I will try just to point out the numbers that are the important points to take away. And before I show numbers, I have to say that this is still in the works. It's not been approved by the USGS. So this is all considered preliminary still. The report's in colleague and outside review right now, so within hopefully a month or so we'll be releasing this and it will be stamped approved. Okay, so let's get going. The purpose of our study was, where does the sediment and where do the contaminants come from? We studied five of the gauged rivers, northeast, northwest, Lower Beaver Dam, Watts, and Hickey. And we did the sampling also on four non-gauge, these small tributaries, Nash, Pope, Fort DuPont, and Fort Stanton. I think everybody knows where these are at, but just, you know, northwest, northeast, we're up above the confluence, Lower Beaver Dam, Watts, Hickey, and then the non-gauge trips were along the east, southeastern shore of the Lower Anacostia. Our approach was to go out during storms and get these large volume samples, 60 or 70 liter samples, composite samples, and filter the sediment out of those large samples and have that analyzed. We did 4 to 5 storms on each of these gauge trips, 2 low flow samples. We also collected freshly deposited bed sediment. Not deep, the stuff that came down the stream during the storm. Okay, so the work completed. At Lower Beaver Dam, we installed and calibrated the gauge, which was very important, you'll see in a minute. And that continues to run through fiscal year 19. For 2017, we've monitored the turbidity in these rivers. Continuously, we sampled 4 to 5 storms. We collected samples during 1 to 2 low flow events, and as I said, we freshly deposited sediment. With all the sediment was analyzed for a suite of PCB conjugates, PAH compounds, both the alkylated and non-alkylated compounds, a whole suite of organic chlorine pesticides, and one storm we were able to trace metals on. We have developed these predictive models for suspended sediment from the turbidity, and from that we've calculated the sediment and chemical loads for the year 2017. As I mentioned, our report is in review now. So now comes the numbers. The large gauged streams. In 2017, there was about 33 million gallons of water came down and from these streams. About 48% came from Northeast Branch, 33% from Northwest Branch, and Lower Beaver Dam, about 16%. We had a total sediment load of almost 33 million kilograms of sediment. 50% of that sediment came from Northwest Branch, 34% from Northeast Branch, 13% from Beaver Dam. These loads work out to be about 90,000, 89,000 kilograms per day, or almost, depends how you calculate, about 90 cubic yards per day of sediment come down. Okay.
Questions so, now, or do you want to wait to the
end? Oh, you can ask. Yeah, go
ahead. So, we've actually that a man reads DC Water, we've been talking to you and some others about that, the gauge in the mainstream of the Anacostia. So is you're looking at percentage of flow here. That's for your study, not assuming that is for the whole Anacostia River, right?
Those are all these tributary inputs to the lower Anacostia, sum up to those numbers. Okay.
If you're just looking at tributaries and the only contribution to the
Anacostia. Right, it's tributary input.
Okay, got it.
And then there's these four non-gauge streams along the southeast coast of the lower Anacostia. These are not gauged, so we can't really tell you exactly how much water and sediment came down. But we used a process where we, using the ratio of the basin area to the area of watts to estimate the sediment and water. And we find that the largest contributor of these small streams of water is Nash Run. It also contributes the most sediment. Okay. The next one would be Fort DuPont, next largest one. And these total up to about 407 million gallons of water from these small streams, about 350,000 kilograms. And below that are the numbers for the gauged tributaries, okay? The sediment, almost 33 million kilograms. This is a very, very tiny percentage of this. Yes?
Yeah, I'm comparing this with your previous table, looking at the yield.
Mm-hmm.
In the previous one, I noticed that the watts had the lowest, and DT was after that, and then northeast, northwest, and lower Beaver Dam. Do you have the yield for these smaller trips?
I do, but it's on a later slide. And
oh, so you have it.
I have those numbers, but I moved the slide because we have too many slides. But the one that sticks out for yield of all of these non-gauged is Nash Run and Fort DuPont. Both have yields that are much like Northeast and Northwest Branch. About three, if you go back one, northeast or northwest and lower Beaver Dam about 3.2 or 32,000 kilograms per square mile, while the other ones are down around 1 or 2. Fort DuPont and Nash are very similar to these. Yes?
Did you do a sediment breakdown? Is that going to be later? Did you look at what kind of grain sizes were coming?
We did, but it's not in here.
Okay, I'll ask you later.
This is all the material that's been being moved. So, anyways, where was I? Okay, the non-gauge streams. We use this ratio method to come up with these, and there are pros and cons to this. It's a traditional method to do this. Watts Basin has a very approximate same land use coverage, especially for Nash and Pope. All of these streams originate on this ridge line at Watts Creek, so they all have approximately the same slope downhill. The cons of this is that Watts Branch has a much higher density of road coverages, more roads cutting through there. And as a result, Watts is a longer reach, and so it may have more point sources coming in. So there's pros and cons to this method, but this is a good estimate.
The tributaries, the total non-gauged ones, did your sampling was at the tide, head of tide or the free flowing? Just trying to figure out how much of the sub-watershed you cover. If that makes sense what I'm asking.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the points I'll get to later.
Okay,
is
that's
that
fine.
Fort DuPont, Fort Stanton, and Pope, they go down, they come down the ridge line, they drop down the hill, and then they go into a storm. And then they go for miles underneath the city, and we have no idea what comes into this in that part. Nash, we're way downstream, it's close to the Anacostia, so it's very much more reliable. So these numbers may not be exactly what make it into the Anacostia. Yes.
I've been working on Watts quite a bit, and the city put in toxic and trash removal at the Arboretum, where it comes above ground, and they very quickly learned that they had a raw sewage signal.
Yep.
And they've identified literally dozens of illicit discharges upstream that they're working on now. So to that extent, it's a bit of an outlier.
Yep.
But ultimately, it will be a good place to go.
I think you're mentioning is Hickey. Hickey comes almost entirely underground and then pops up at the Arboretum.
I mean, yeah, I don't know.
And it is not really, in my mind, a natural natural stream. Whereas
Watts
comes down the hill and wanders through the city and wanders through the residential areas.
Right.
Fort DuPont, Fort Stanton come out of the side of the hill and come through parks and come down. So it's a different, each one's got its unique kind of thing and situation. I chose Watts because of the conditions in Hickey. They just are not the same beast. They're not the same type of stream. Okay? One of the things I wanted to emphasize is our work on Lower Beaver Dam. Putting this gauge in was very, very important because this stream, when it rains, this is a torrent of water and sediment. It's got very high velocities. It'll get up to 7 or 8 feet per second. I mean, it just rolls boulders. It'll roll boulders, you know, cobbles down the stream at that fast. It takes 30 minutes after it starts to rain to turn into this. And it carries a lot of sediment. In 2016, Lower Beaver Dam provided 16% of the total discharge to the Anacostia. And more importantly, it provided almost five times more sediment than the combination of Watts and Hickey. And so a lot of material comes down this stream. And
so when you say 16% discharge, what would be the percentage of sediment proportionate to that? I'm trying to figure out your...
It comes up later. That's good point. Okay. So what about the chemistry? Here's what we found. We averaged all our storm and low flow samples together. Just hit some of the big ones here. Total PCBs, northeast, northwest branch, very low, 5 or 6 micrograms per kilogram. The big one, the average was in Lower Beaver Dam, 130. You can see the difference. Hickey and Watts are, you know, order of magnitude higher than northeast, northwest branch. So there are PCBs coming down those. The pHs are pretty much similar through, except for Hickey, and that's not unsurprising. You go and you watch Hickey, and you'll see oil. You'll see evidences of oils and greases and everything coming down through there. So there's a source of high pHs there. Most of the pHs are these alkylated. The alkylated forms that we normally talk about. Okay, next one, please. So in the streams, the nine-gauge streams, dominantly Nash run. Okay, it's similar in PCBs to Watts Branch. It's right next door to Watts Branch. You know, it has the same land use. Total pHs are high, non-uplated ones. Pope, Fort DuPont, Fort Stanton, very low. One would almost like to say that those might be background kind of concentrations for urban area. Again, to address this one point, these streams dump into these storm sewers and go underground, and we have no idea what gets put in down there. So this may not be the chemistry that makes it to the river. Okay, next one. So the loadings, the big thing always is kind of been the pesticides. Our pesticide sampling began in the middle of summer, so we only had 1 or 2 storm samples, whereas we had 4 or 5, even 6 storm samples for PCBs. and the analytic methods ended up with some unexpectedly high detection limits. So we had a few hits on these pesticides. So the approach that I took to getting these loads, the concentrations were developed using the highest concentration of all the samples for that river, whatever the highest concentration was. But I want to make a point to that, is that the chloridane was found in measurable concentrations of all the gauged tributaries. Okay. So just as an example, here are the hits and the number of hits and the concentrations, and I've highlighted the ones that stick out. Chloridane, Northeast Branch, Northwest Branch, the highest, or a high one in the Lower Beaver Dam, the highest in watts for chloridane. We also found other pesticides in this freshly deposited bed sediment. And these included the chloridane, a suite of the DDTs, dieldrin and endrin aldehyde, and some of them are pretty high concentrations. So there are pesticides besides chloridane out there. And yes, chloridane is the highest pesticide found. So next, loads. Here are the loadings from the gauged tributaries. Total PCBs, the toxicity PCB equivalents, the non-alkylated pHs, and the chloridane ones, and I've highlighted the big numbers. Lower Beaver Dam, 580 grams per year of PCBs. It represents 73% of the total PCB loading, which is about almost 800 grams per year. It's also the most toxic, about an order of magnitude, but it's interesting that Northeast Branch has roughly the same toxicity. That non-alkylated PCB pH loads, about 39 kilograms per year, come from Northwest Branch, which is 59%. And then the chloridane is about 1,200 grams per year, and it's almost, well, the highest percentage comes from Northeast Branch, and then Northwest Branch and Lower Beaver Dam make up the remainder.
These are all wet weather sampling or the base flow combined?
This is, well, for the chemistry, it's the average of both the average of the low flow and the storm. And for the sediment part of the load, it's minute by minute calculation of the sediment. It's not an estimate.
And this is suspended sediment only, right?
This is all suspended material. I talked about the bed sediment, right? Because the pesticides you could measure in the bed sediment, the fresh bed sediment. But the analytic methods didn't allow us to see low enough in the suspended sediment.
And you didn't look at what is in the water itself, because that would be very low.
Dissolve phase, no, this is just the sediment.
Okay. Mostly hydrophobic anyway.
Yep, that's Dr.
Oh, okay.
So we'll get the takeaway points here in a minute. I know there's lots of numbers, sorry, but this is what leads to this loading kind of thing. Okay, next slide, please. The non-gauged Nash run is the highest, almost entirely. The non-gauge tributary loads of PCBs come from Nash Run. Same with the toxicity. Same with the non-alkylated pH loads. Okay, but you can see the total loadings are very small compared to the. It's two orders of magnitude lower than what come down the gauge streams. Oh, well, back up for 1 second. Chloridane was not found in any of these small tributaries, either in the suspended material or in the bed sediment. And so it's not coming in from these little tributaries. Okay, so just to summarize this whole mess of numbers, total water, 33 million gallons. The majority comes from Northeast Branch. You can see how much larger the volume of water is compared to the non-gauge streams. The non-gauge ones, Nash Run, is the major contributor. sediment, about 33 million kilograms. 50% of that comes from Northwest Branch, 34 Northeast, and 13 from Lower Beaver Dam. PCBs, almost 800 grams per year, and the majority, about three quarters of that, comes from Lower Beaver Dam. The PAHs, about 66,000 grams per year, about 60% come from Northwest Branch. Total chloridane, 1,200 grams, and it's about evenly distributed between Northeast, Northwest, and Lower Beaver Dam. Okay, and again, these non-gauge streams are just little tiny percentages, very, very small percentages, probably within the noise of any of these numbers. Analytic uncertainties. Next one, that's the summary, the takeaway. Again, majority of water and sediment come from Northwest, Northeast. Lower Beaver Dam contributes the majority of PCBs, but it also supplies a high proportion of these contaminants relative to its drainage area, its basins. It's 14 square miles, and it contributes a very large percentage to the total loads. Non-gauge streams, very little. Chloridane is present in all the gauge tributaries. It wasn't detected in the non-gauge, but there are other pesticides in those streams that are being transported in the sediment. Some recommendations. I feel it's really important to keep this discharge and water quality monitoring at Lower Beaver Dam, Northwest, Northeast, Watts, and Hickey in order to get this variation in the yearly loads. Okay, our support for Lower Beaver Dam ends in fiscal year 19, so we've got a year to come up with some more funding to keep that station going. The other stations are part of the USGS network, and they will be continued to be monitored. I recommend we sample more, sample again for at Lower Beaver Dam, Hickey, Watts, and Nash, and especially for pesticides. When you look close at our work, we only have one or two sets of samples here to come up with these loads. And the idea is to get the best characteristic of the sediment. I think that would really be an important addition. Third one would be conduct a synoptic track down sampling in Lower Beaver Dam, Watts, and Hickey for all the COCs. And I mean, synoptic sampling is you take one storm and you sample in two or three or four different places in the storm and find out on a mass basis where the contaminants come from. I recommend additional sampling at the outfalls of these small streams to actually find out really what makes it to the lower Anacostia. I made a recommendation to the DOE to measure discharge turbidity and other water quality parameters at lower Anacostia below the confluence of the Northeast-Northwest Branch in Aquatic Gardens, and downstream from that near the lower Anacostia Potomac confluence, in order to get a mass balance of sediment and water that actually sloshes around in that lower reach and eventually gets swept out. Right now we can't really tell that, and that we have ways to do that. It would also allow, as they cut off these combined sewer overflows, you'd be able to see the document the differences that will cause in the lower Anacostia. So this one I think is really, really important. I think we're going to get funding to put the aquatic gardens station in, but I really think we need one downstream as well.
There was already a station at the aquatic gardens.
Yeah, that.
But it was a gauge.
It was a gauge. These would be acoustic ones that would measure not only it would measure velocity, state, discharge, and with the water quality parameters, we could do the turbidity and the full suite, just like we did at Lower Beaver Dam. And it would be able to work this, the tidal cycling to come up with really what moves through the lower Anacostia. And a last one would be to go up into the Northeast Northwest Branch in Fort DuPont and look, try to find out where the areas of erosion are coming from. Where does the sediment come from in those basins? Okay, you go to Fort DuPont, you can see where the sediment comes from. It's the erosion of the hill. You go to find these places in Northeast Northwest Branch and maybe do some remediation to try to cut down on the sediment that's coming down these rivers, these bigger tributaries. So that's the end of it. Lots of numbers, reports coming out soon, and questions.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the massive loading from the northwest, northeast, and the river. Do you have a feel? I suspect it's primarily during the storm events,
yes,
rather than the base flow. So in terms of any kind of implementation strategy, it would be looking at the stabilizing,
yep,
the streams in a way to reduce the sediments, because most of these are piggybacking on the sediments, the contaminants.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So right. Base flow generally should be contributing minimal amount.
Yes. In the report, I have a section about that. I call it the equivalent base flow days. One storm, I do an example. One storm will be have an equivalent load of maybe 150 base flow days. Okay, so it's clear that the storms move the sediment.
And I'm really confused about Nash Run. I still don't know why it is what it is, because we have worked on restoration of it.
I don't think it's so much the sediment coming. I think there's sources upstream there that need to be found, just like there's sources in Hickey up in the stream that need to be found.
So the Nash Run, I wondered if I could lead you to a bill. The Anacostia Riverkeeper manages the trash trap on Nash Run right before the restored area, right when it comes out of the culvert. Mm-hmm. We've got an enormous sandbar that's formed in just the past 9 months. And the sandbar is probably the size of four of these tables. And as of this past 2 months, it's about 3.5 feet tall.
Yep.
And that just wasn't there,
yep,
a year ago. So I've actually been talking to DOE, trying to figure out where that sediment might be coming from.
It's the same case in Hickey. You know, that sediment trap fills up in a year, and it's a massive amount of sediment. And a lot of it's washed off the streets, but there are places that erosion continues.
Was it more fines or more sand? Or
well, what you see deposited is sand and silt,
okay,
in the deposits.
Is your the work you did on Hope Ranch, was that post-restoration, all of it?
Yeah.
Or did you get some pre-restoration,
post-restoration? It was in 2017, so...
Just after.
Okay. You know, what we really should be thinking about is some opportunities to do before or after here. And the one that's popping up is Hickey, because Springhouse has now been restored and is removing a tremendous amount through its restoration practices.
Yeah.
We're about to announce a start on Hickey the same way.
Okay.
And it would be great to do before and after on Hickey Run to get a sense of what you can do with current technologies,
uh-huh,
in terms of natural removal systems.
We actually do that, but we don't do it for camp. But we do pre and post implementation, not really do it for sediment.
For post.
For anywhere that we do implementation,
so
but we don't look at the chemicals.
Okay.
Organics and stuff is just too expensive.
One of the things about those sediment traps is it's very easy just to core one of those sediment traps and then homogenize the sediment, because you know it was suspended material. You know, you're not down in the lithographic substrata. It's stuff that came down the stream, got caught. It does, however, with time, you can wash out all the fines and you end up with the sands, and the fines are where you're going to get the contaminants. But a fresh deposit, like you mentioned in Nash, you go and you core that, that's the material that's moving down. And it's a lot easier. Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Just kind of a basic point, Tim. The massive loads of sediment coming down, particularly during storms, how much of it is erosion from stream beds versus washing off the streets, washing off the surface?
There are ways to tell that. I can't tell you that. I can tell you that from observation, there is bank erosion. When you learn about this, bank erosion occurs after a certain point, a certain velocity and height in the streams. So that's, you know, big storms, you get the bank erosion. Smaller storms, you're just moving stuff along that's been deposited from the stream bed.
So smaller storms, you're getting relatively more wash off from the surface.
Yeah.
And then when you get the real big blowouts,
you get to a certain point, then you start cutting away the banks, and that's where the extra sediment. But
presumably, most of the contaminant load is coming off the surface, not the sediment in the street banks.
That's kind of arguable, because a lot of that sediment used to be farmed. It used to have pesticides and all kinds of stuff in it, right?
We have ways that we can partition that sediment based on our land use sediment fingerprints, where you go and sample pools or sample sediments across the watershed and then use various elements to match up with what you're collecting, and you can get a proportion of sediments that is going down the stream, be it bank, be it surface, streets. Alan Gallus in my office, he was one of the new players in the sediment category in the community that does that. He actually has developed a program called SetSnap that will take this information and give you the percentage of where it's coming from.
And has he done any work here?
Perhaps in
in my opinion, have three places that contaminants come from. And that is, first of all, wash off from the streets into the storm sewers and right out into the stream. And you can see the storm water bringing that. The second is surface runoff that comes off the land and then drops into the stream. And then the third one is this: during high storms, the bank erosion itself, where the stream would widen, slope in, and that contaminant would be historic from years and years and years ago that has seeped into the grounds. But so it's two surface ones, the runoff from the streets and the surface soil runoff. That's probably where the majority of these chemicals come from. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, so now we have Dr. Ghosh. There was a question on dissolved contaminants, and he will answer all our questions.
If you have time to create this
topic. So Dr. Ghosh is back with his second or third time, maybe? Probably third time, maybe more, I don't know. But he's a professor at Maryland Baltimore County and in the Department of Chemical, Biochemical, and Environmental Engineering, and focuses on pollutants and transport.
Thank you for having me here. As Doug said, you have seen some of the data that I have presented to this audience before. I'm going to focus a little more on the implications and what it tells us about how the loads that you heard from Tim relate to impacts in water quality, in aquatic resources, human health. And to understand that link between the loads that are coming in to the chemicals, so my focus is on toxic chemicals, PCBs, some of the pesticides, and the PAHs. The way these contaminants get into the fish is through some kind of a water phase transport. So the concentrations in the water are really important. In terms of total mass, what's there in the water is very small, but it's the mode of transport into the organisms. So if you think about a fish, you can go to the next slide. If you think about the fish, it's spending a huge amount of time breathing through the gills, exchanging oxygen. But in the same process, it's exchanging everything else that's there in the water phase. So if I have PCB molecules floating in the water, it's picking it up through the gills. Depending on the fish, the percentage of total uptake into the fish can be somewhere between, say, 40 to 70% of the total mass that gets into the fish is coming through the breathing process, and that's primarily driven by the dissolved concentrations in the water.
Even you compare with the bottom feeders that they suck the sediments?
The bottom feeders feed on the worms. They're primarily going after the worms and the clams, and these worms and the clams are getting those PCBs again from a water phase transport through the pore water and the sediments, or if they're sticking their tail out to breathe, or they're, you know, if it's a clam, it's putting out the, what do you call it, the siphon to feed on the particles, cestin and the phytoplankton. It's getting impacted by the water column. The other mechanism is the algae and the zooplankton that's floating in the water. They are exchanging with the water column, with the water concentration that's in the water. And you have the food chain in the pelagic food web that's going in the fish, or in the benthic food web that's going in the fish. So there's a food-based uptake, the ingestion uptake. In the process of ingesting some of these organisms, the catfish might also eat some of the sediments and process it in the gut. But in large part, a huge part of that exposure is really controlled by the dissolved concentration. Dissolved in the water column, or dissolved in the pore water within the sediments, the water that exists in the pore structure within these sediments. So a big focus of my work was dissolved concentrations, and so I highlighted that there. So human exposure, when you talk about human exposure and fish consumption advisories, it's really driven by the fish and indirectly with the water column concentrations. And that's the reason why you have US EPA criteria for human health for fish consumption, based on fish consumption, for PCBs and some of these pesticides, which are based on freely dissolved concentrations in the water column. The water, so to be able to control or reduce, if that's the goal, to reduce levels in the fish, we need to reduce what's in the water. To reduce what's in the water, we have to figure out where is it coming from into the dissolved phase in the water. There are bed sediments, some of which is contaminated. There are areas that have repositories, legacy repositories or PCBs. So you can imagine there's flux going on. We did measure those fluxes from sediments into the water column. There are inputs from tributaries and outfalls. We didn't get into the outfalls, but we looked at some of the major tributaries that you heard about and looked at the dissolved concentrations coming down the tributaries. And then there is a big air-water exchange that could happen for some of these chemicals. These are semi-volatile chemicals, so there is exchange between the air phase and the water phase, especially when the surface area is large, especially for the tidal portion of the Athabasca River. These are difficult to measure. These concentrations are at the nanograms, sub-nanograms per liter levels. So they're very difficult. I can't go and grab a liter of sample to measure those concentrations. I have to use a different way. In the past, we use large volumes of water, try to filter out the particles, and then measure what's in there. And it's messy, because you still can't get the dissolved organic carbon out. So the state of the art that is emerging right now from research into practice is what is called passive sampling. So we use the property that makes it difficult to measure these chemicals in the water phase to help us. So these are super hydrophobic chemicals. So what we use is a hydrophobic membrane, a polyethylene sheet. We put it out in the water and let it equilibrate with the water phase. We know very accurately what that partitioning is. So if I have a nanogram per liter in the water, I'll have a milligram per kilogram in the polymer, or whatever that ratio is very well figured out in the lab. And people have come to a consensus on those partitioning values. So just like the lipids in the organisms, these polymers, if I can, so the polymers are very standard. So it's not like one fish being different from another fish with different lipid content, but I can have a very standardized material that I can put out in the water and sense what the dissolved concentration is. And I can bring that polymer back, do some calculations and figure out what that water concentration is very accurately. So that's what we did here to measure those concentrations. So you have students putting them out into the river, on the riverbed. So the way we designed it for these shallow streams is to place those passive samplers inside the holes of a cinder block and anchor it down in the bed. The water is flowing through it, and we are getting an integrated measurement over a period of about 3 months of exposure. And we can do the same thing in the air phase, so that polymer is inside those bowls, protecting it from direct deposition and water from rainfall. But I have a different calculation, but I can calculate the concentrations in the air phase, gas phase concentration. And this is not just research, it's emerging into standardized methods that US EPA is, I've been working with the EPA to develop these standard methods to be able to take it out from the research phase for commercial use. So it's going there. So here are some of the locations. We have locations for water samplers that are a couple of them in the Anacostia River and several in the tributaries. We have air samplers around in this air shed to get a sense of what the concentrations are in the air phase. And then in coordination with Fred and College Park, we also analyze these pollutants in the mussels deployed in the watershed. So I'm going to primarily focus on the water. Let's go to the next slide. So I'm going to go through quickly some of the concentrations that we see in these in the water phase. So these are dissolved concentrations in the water phase. This is where our this is our background site, Zakaya Swamp in southern Maryland, where our mussels came from. This is the Beaver Dam Creek. So these are PCB concentrations in the water. The scale is in nanograms per liter. So that's those are the units we're using. And northeast, northwest branches, the dissolved concentrations are very low. So these two branches, as you heard from Tim, bring in the maximum volume of water. But the dissolved concentration in the water is extremely low. It's below the 10 raised to minus 5 cancer risk for humans, but above 10 raised to minus 6 cancer risk for human exposure. Watts branch, it's higher than that. These two just jump out. And you have seen that reflected in the suspended sediments as well that you saw in Tim's talk. Very large levels of dissolved PCBs coming down Lower Beaver Dam Creek. These two are our two locations that we did on our first deployment in the Anacostia River. This is Kingman Lake, and this is the near the, it's in the river close to the O Street outfall. That's in the river. What you see is that total PCB concentrations in the tidal portion of the river is not a whole lot different at these two sites. And we have done subsequent work at two other sites, and it's kind of in that range of about 1.5 nanograms per liter. That's higher than the 10 to the minus 5 cancer risk, which says that the PCBs are accumulating in the fish at a high enough level that it's going to have an impact of more than 10 in a million additional or incremental cancer cases in a population. That's basically what this is saying. And that's why we have fish consumption advisories. Yes?
Is it your methodology lend itself to use that concentration to look at the flow, for instance, from Lower Beaver Dam Creek, because it's massive, to sort of not an exact load, but get to some idea that maybe a massive amount of that stuff actually is coming from Lower Beaver Dam? Because you can have that stuff in Watts Branch or a lot of those other
I'll get into the loading.
The flow is so small. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. So this has to be looked at in the context of what the flows are. And I'll get to that in the next few slides. Yeah, let's see that. So so that was the PCB story. The pH story is a little different. Concentrations are higher in the river itself compared to some of the tributaries. So there's, that's the quick story of the PAHs. Let's go to the next. The DDT in the water. Some of these tributaries have higher than the cancer risk, and Kingman Lake is lower. O Street, near O Street outfall, you get a much higher level of the DDT. So the picture with the pesticides is different from the picture for the PCBs. Let's go to the next. The same thing with the chlordanes. High concentrations of the chlordanes near the O Street outfall. So these are, remember again, these are dissolved concentrations in the water, which is what the fish and the plants and all the organisms are getting exposed to and would reflect in the tissue concentrations. So let's go to the next. And we see that. So when Fred and his colleagues deployed the muscles, we got the tissue back and we analyzed. So these are the bigger muscles. We had enough tissue to do the analysis of PCBs and pesticides. So this is just the PCB picture. Lower Beaver Dam, the muscles deployed in Lower Beaver Dam had the highest concentration in the tissue, which is reflected in the high concentration we get in the water phase, in the surface water phase in Lower Beaver Dam, and lower in some of these. So it's reflecting water dissolved concentrations in the water phase. And we can use models to predict what these concentrations would be in the muscles if I know how much fatty tissue the muscle has. So basically, it's a pretty straightforward calculation. There's an important message here in this slide. So you heard from Tim about the sediment loads and the pollutants associated with the sediments. One of the things that I'm going to show you is that it's important to take inventory of the total masses coming down or that are present in the sediment. But it doesn't tell you, if you just look at focus on the total mass, it doesn't tell you enough to figure out what the exposures and the risks are going to be. So what we did here is plotted the PCBs in suspended sediments, collected, I think some of the data are from Tim. The concentrations in those suspended sediments during storms are really, really low. So we look at the concentrations compared to what's in the bed in the Anacostia River. So we looked at 10 sediment samples in the Anacostia River. These are these concentrations in the range of 100 to 1,000 micrograms per kilogram. Compared to that, the concentrations you can barely see in the suspended sediments during a storm. So yes, the storms bring down tons of sediments, especially northeast and northwest branches. But those sediments are helping deposit a cleaner layer of sediments on top of what's there in Anacostia River, and it's much cleaner than what's there in the Anacostia River. Lower Beaver Dam is a little different picture. The sediments are also contaminated and somewhat high, but northeast, northwest branches, PCBs, especially PCBs, the concentrations are really, really low. It's not having a negative impact on the river. It's actually having a positive impact on the river. So I want to make that point very clear. That's what's emerging from our comparison here. We talked about loads being small. The total mass loads are small during base flow, but the concentrations are much higher during base flow in the dissolved phase, and also if you calculate it in the suspended solids. So the mass loadings are really small, well, much smaller compared to the storm loadings, but the concentrations are coming up at a much higher level. The concentrations are getting diluted down during the storms. In large part, it's getting diluted down. For PAHs, the picture is a little different, but for PCBs, during the storms, the concentrations are getting diluted down in a big way. So that's one thing I wanted to point out here.
Where's that spike?
This one is, I have to go back.
Oh, that's not cold. That's not cold.
These samples were collected by Tetra Tech, I believe, in 2017.
Have you looked at when you say the dilution during the storm event in the water column versus the total volume? Still proportionately during the storm event you get more, despite the fact
mass.
That you diluted.
So mass, yes. Slightly more during the storms. But the mass loading, I think I have a few slides I can show you. Mass loadings during the base flow is small, but the concentration in which it's coming out is much higher.
It's also, grain size in base flow is very, very small.
Right.
You know, for it to be suspended in base flow, it's like really super small, so concentration is correlated with grain size as well. And some of that may never settle out.
No, you're absolutely right. And the nature of the sediments, the particles are also different. It's more organic-rich material during base flow than in the storm flow. So, Tim, if you you may recall from the suspended sediments during storm flow, the organic carbon content is really, really small. Right?
The finest particles are organic rich.
Yeah.
It's just
It's clay with organic matter either attached to it or floating in the stream. It's very tiny, fine-grained stuff.
So let's go to the next slide.
Rupal?
Yeah.
Just if you can go back to that for a second. I'm just not seeing much difference between Lower Beaver Dam 1 and Northwest Branch there. The blue.
The difference is in the storms, but during, so this is during base flow,
mm-hmm.
concentrations in suspended solids.
Okay, not water column.
Yeah, not the water column.
Okay.
So I'll show the water column if you go to the next slide. Let's see, this is the freely dissolved concentrations. So if you look at the freely dissolved concentrations, Lower Beaver Dam is way up there between 5 and 6, whereas Northeast, Northwest are actually lower than what you have in the Anacostia River. So if you think about the dissolved concentrations coming down Northeast and Northwest branches, they are in about half of what's, or less than half of what's already there in the Anacostia River. So these flows are actually diluting down what you already have in the Anacostia River, whereas this one is actually adding to what you have in the Anacostia River.
So the last column, when you say Anacostia River, reflects the loading that has already come down from Lower Beaver Dam Creek and diluted with everything.
Exactly. Yeah. Plus whatever is coming up from sediments and CSOs. So this is what you have at steady state in the Anacostia River over that period of time. So two messages here. Lower Beaver Dam Creek jumps out in terms of dissolved concentration loads, and the concentrations, dissolved concentrations in the storms are typically much lower than what you have during base flow, except for Dickey Run, they're kind of about the same. And in the Lower Beaver Dam Creek, they're starting to get close to each other. Let's go to the next. No, I think we went the other way.
Yep.
So if I start putting together a box model of inputs and outputs into the river, we have figured some of these out. There are still some unknowns like CSOs, but we have characterized some of these inputs into the river. Now, the first slide here is total PCB inputs. This is suspended solids and dissolved together. If I add everything up in terms of masses, and I get 15 grams per year from Watts and Hickey, Low Beaver Dam 400. So this is slightly different calculation, but kind of getting close to what even what also Tim does with a different type of assessment. Upstream, this is Northeast and Northwest branches, I get about 165 grams per year. So compared to Northeast, Northwest branches, Lower Beaver Dam has a much bigger contribution. We also figured out the loadings from the sediment hotspots, because we cannot forget that. There are areas within the river which has legacy sediments, which is contributing to flux. If you have higher pore water concentration there, it's going to diffuse into the water column. And we figured that out, and that comes to 151 grams per year from hotspots. I'm calling these hotspots as areas that are contributing load into the water column. There are cleaner parts of the river where the opposite is happening, because the water column has about 1.4 nanograms per liter. If you have clean sediments, the clean sediments are going to soak it up. And that's happening at about an equivalent rate in the cleaner parts of the river. The air water, I presented some of the data in the previous talks, but basically it's a net volatilization of PCBs from river into the air. It's not the other way around. It's not going from air to water. It's going from water to the air phase. And that's a big amount that we calculate. Let's go to the next. So that's the total PCB load. Now if I just look at the dissolved load, dissolved concentration, which has the most impact, again, Lower Beaver Dam jumps out as the big one. 94 grams per year of dissolved PCBs coming into the water, into the Anacostia, compared to one from the smaller branches and 18 from Northeast and Northwest. Right. Northeast and Northwest has the highest net flow going in, right? About 50% of the total flow is coming from Northeast, Northwest branches. This has 13% of the flow, but a huge contribution of dissolved PCBs coming in. Sediment hotspots, this is basically, we looked at diffusion, so this is dissolved PCBs coming from the contaminant sediments into the water column. It's 151 grams per year. It's comparable to what's coming from Lower Beaver Dam. And as I said, is going back
into... Before you continue,
yes.
I'm just curious, when you're looking at the air volatilization, I'm comparing that it looks like we are in a steady state. I mean, we are losing more to the air than we are actually gaining from...
No, that's a good point. The thing is, we have to keep in mind there are many inputs that we are not really accounting for in this mass balance. So,
but if you keep on what you know, what you currently know, we are having a, if you let it, don't do anything about it, theoretically, eventually, you're going to have much lower concentration because of what's going on. I'm not talking about the sediments, but I'm talking about the mass balance in the water column.
Yeah, the water column with the PCBs from the water would volatilize out into the air. But this is happening at steady state. There is also flux coming from sediments.
Right.
So these inputs and outputs are kind of balancing out. And then we haven't even looked at the output going downstream into the photomat. They're kind of in the if we really account for everything, they should balance out, right? Mass balance should work. So sediment hotspots and Lower Beaver Dam Creek contribute the most of the dissolved PCBs into the river. So let's go to the last slide. So one of the things we also did is when we did these flux calculations from sediments into the water column, we looked at hot spots and cold spots. And this is from the Tetra Tech report looking at area demarcations within the tidal portion of the Anacostia, which were color-coded into gray areas, low concentrations, green areas, little higher concentrations, going up to the red areas, which is more than 800 micrograms per kilogram. And we took the midpoint of each of those ranges and calculated the flux into the water column. And what we see is that these red areas and the orange areas are fluxing PCBs from the sediments into the water column. And remember, I told you the cleaner portions, which are the yellow, blue, yellow, green, and the black, are acting as sinks of PCBs. And this is based on the current dissolved concentration in the water that we see, about 1.4 nanograms per liter. So somewhere around 100 micrograms per kilogram in the sediments, you switch over from being a sink to a source within the sediment phase. And that's an interesting number to think about, where the sediments are becoming a problem versus the sediments are being impacted by the bad water quality. So let's go to the last slide. And so this is my picture. So I started off with a conceptual model of PCBs and inputs and outputs into the river and uptake into fish. And this is what is emerging for us. Lower Beaver Dam Creek. If you think about the color, that's the contribution of dissolved PCBs coming Lower Beaver Dam Creek. We have some hot spots that are diffusing PCBs into the water column. And that's giving you the average concentration you see in the lower in the Anacostia River, which is about 1.4 nanograms per liter, which is getting picked up with the fish and the mussels and the clams and phytoplankton and all the aquatic life, and doing the impacts that these chemicals have. That's the picture. Northwest branches are relatively clean in terms of their contribution. So main sources of dissolved PCBs, Lower Beaver Dam and sediment hotspots. We're using new and the latest technology to measure these very difficult to measure low concentrations in the water phase. The high concentration in the water is causing net volatilization from water into the air phase. We show that the dissolved concentrations in the water reflect what aquatic life is getting exposed to and accumulating. And one other big message is that the strong sediments generally are cleaner than the river sediments, except for Lower Beaver Dam. But the northwest branches that bring in the majority load of sediments are actually cleaner than majority of the sediments already there in the Anacostia River. So those are some of the big points I wanted to make here. Really need to work these two out to get a cleaner Anacostia. I'm happy to take questions.
Dr. Gross, I have a question.
Yeah.
In terms of the flux from sediments to surface water, does it make a difference? We talk about superficial concentrations or berry concentration? Does it make any difference how deep or what the relative concentrations are in the cell?
Yeah, there are different ways to look at it in the scientific community. People look at the bioactive zone, which is the zone, maybe it depends on the site, can be 4 inches, 6 inches, which is actively mixed up by organisms and has a concentration that is responsible for the flux into the water column. Now, there can be processes in some sites where things go deeper and move things around, but typically where you define the surface sediments that's responsible for that flux is based on what's moving things around there.
Yeah, when you look at the concentration of, I'm not just talking about PCB, all the organics, the concentration in sediments could be order of magnitude or more than the water column.
Well, absolutely. It's actually six orders of magnitude.
Okay, so looking at it that way, I'm just wondering, what is the significance of looking at the water column itself? Because most of the fish we are looking at are bottom feeders. They go suck up everything there and spit it out. So it seems like we can use the water column just as a point of reference rather than a place to start cleaning up. Just sediment should be the one that we have to focus on. Am I wrong or am I looking at the wrong?
No, that is what one would think, but the water concentrations are absolutely important even for the fish that are bottom feeding. Now, for the bottom feeders, the pore water concentrations might be a little more relevant than the surface water concentrations. But even the bottom feeding fish has to breathe, and it mostly breathes surface water. So even for the bottom feeders, it may not be 80%, but it will be something like 40% of the uptake that is happening through the surface. The pore water is important. So the way these chemicals get into the fish has to be through some kind of a water pathway. So even if the sediments are ingested by the organism, it has to pass through the gut membrane in the gut fluid. So the propensity of these chemicals to come off the sediment into the water phase is an indicator of how bioavailable those chemicals are. So people have struggled with it. We have struggled for a long time to try to explain how chemicals go from sediments into organisms. And there are different pathways, but it always boils down to some kind of an aquatic pathway that it has to pass through. Therefore, for bottom feeders, the pore water concentrations in the sediments might be a little more relevant than the surface water concentrations, but it's still a water mechanism.
So I'm wondering about that top 6 inches. If we had, say, the massive hurricane that we may have dodged, would that change that depth that you consider potential for turning around?
Absolutely. That has to be part of the calculus. That's why I kind of phrased my question saying that it depends on what the mixing depth is. So if the mixing depth can be assured to be the bioactive zone, that's one calculation. But I have worked at sites where it's a Navy yard and we have tugboats that stir up the sediments down to 2-3 feet every time the tugboat comes in to pull out the aircraft carrier. That's a different calculation there.
But you could calculate for, you know, a 100-year storm or whatever, what that mixing depth would be?
I don't do that calculation.
Really,
I need a hydrogeologist and
really
people who do sediment
depth
movement.
For a storm, it's an erosional depth, and then that 6 inches gets, or however thick, gets picked up, moved down, and a new 6 inches, well, maybe 4 inches or 3 inches will get deposited at that. And like Upal was saying, the sediment coming down the northeast, northwest branch is clean sediment. So big storms, it's the same with Passaic and Raritan and New York Harbor, they get cleaned up when you have these big storms. But then the sediment starts building up, and then you redevelop this mixing zone of the organisms in the top of the sediment.
So, hey Fred, we are looking at those scenarios, like in terms of the hydrodynamic model, looking at 100-year flood plain, you know, in terms of what
that
impact. So I think those studies will be available.
Okay.
We have to move to our next speaker, but I'm sure Dr. Ghosh will mill around a bit at the end for additional questions. So. Our next speaker is on a topic that's much different than these. So, as you know, we're keeping track of all the development that's going on in the Anacostia as we characterize the Anacostia and also as we think about what some of the cleanup options might be. So, one of the things that we looked at was some of the work that was done in the Charles River where they're looking towards a swimmable Charles. And Charles Watershed Society started working with a local architect firm to say, okay, if we're going to swim in the river, how can we do this? And this is being done in other cities around the world. And so since we're looking towards a swimmable Anacostia, hopefully, in the somewhat foreseeable future, we wanted to start looking at that now, why we look at all the different options that we're thinking about for its restoration. So,
can I say a word while you're looking for that?
Yes, you can. And so the Smith Group has given a donation to the Anacostia Waterfront Trust to develop this, we'll say it's really a pre-feasibility study on looking at swimming facilities in the Anacostia River.
That's what I was going to say. Go ahead.
It's a nice Friday night vision picture up there, too.
And the introduction of our speaker.
Oh, so Merrill's the top dog at the Smith Group, and they have volunteered a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of their staff, very professional staff, to help us out on this potential swimming project. And she's been the project lead on it, and it's been just great to work with. So thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for your time this morning. I wanted to give a bit of an update on where we are with this study. And I do want to say that it's not just Smith Group that's been working on this. We have been guided in very expert ways by Aaron Barnes Holmes at the Trust and Gretchen, as well as folks from the National Park Service and Federal City Council. So the way we're structuring this study is to answer a number of questions, and in answering them, we're hoping to generate excitement about the possibility of swimming in the Anacostia and what that could look like. So these are the questions that we have at this moment that we anticipate people will have in considering, you know, whether this is a real possibility. So our first question is, why swimming? Why would you swim in the Anacostia River? Swimming in DC is a very popular activity, and Play DC is the Department of Parks and Recreation's vision for recreation and play around the city. And in looking at aquatic facilities, they have certain targets: indoor pool within 2 miles, outdoor pool within 1.5 miles, a splash pad within 1 mile. And they identify this area, the Anacostia area, generally speaking, that it needs a splash pad. That's one thing that's missing. The survey from DOEE for the river use also brought up a question, a number of questions about swimming in the Anacostia. And this one in particular I picked out is really about whether you would use it. How would you swim in the Anacostia, assuming that things are in a state where swimming is possible? So you can see from the answers that a number of people responded that they would swim in the Anacostia, and relatively frequently. So
could you read those? We can't read them back here.
Yes, sure. So the question is, the District of Columbia is committed to the goal of a swimmable Anacostia River in the future when the river meets water quality standards. How often would you swim in the river? Swimming once a month for 30 minutes on the left, swimming twice a month for 30 minutes, swimming once a week for 1 hour, swimming once a day for 1 hour or more, and then I would not swim in the Anacostia River. So, another reason to swim in the Anacostia is because there's a history in our city of segregation. And in the past, during the 1950s and 1960s, in that era, as we interviewed Mr. Dennis Chestnut, he recounted how African-American youth on really hot days wanted very much to swim in the city and were turned away from pools or assaulted on their way through the neighborhoods, and so they turned to the Anacostia River as a place where they could cool off and swim. And unfortunately, this had some very tragic consequences because of the nature of the river and of the inability of kids to swim. Along with that, Play DC also identified adult and youth learn to swim programs as being something very much desired and important. And so we want to bring back a bit of environmental justice and social justice to the city by providing opportunities for everybody to swim both in and out of the river. And of course, it's the year of the Anacostia. What more joyous way to celebrate the clean river than by swimming in it? Is it really possible here? So our study, of course, assumes that yes, it will be possible. All of the great work that is being done will get us there, and the study will explain through answering this question how that will be possible. It will talk about all the cleanup activities that are happening. Has this been done before? Yes, it's been done and is being done all over the world.